Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the well-lit basement studios of the North Carolina General Assembly, you've located the WUNC Politics Podcast. Good to have you along. I'm Jeff Tiberi. It is Thursday, April 11th, 2019. Medicaid and infanticide on the pod this week. It was a heavy health week here at the legislature. Here to talk about it is a nurse who occasionally quintuples her hats as founder, chief operating officer, editor-in-chief, and award-winning jam maker. She's all about North Carolina Health News. She is North Carolina Health News. Rose Hoban, welcome back to the podcast. How are
Thank
you?
Thank you very much. I have a wonderful team. It is not just me. I have great people working with me.
It's not, but you do wear all those hats.
I do, yeah.
Are those fair?
Yeah, they're fair.
Okay. On Tuesday, House Representative Donnie Lambeth, a Republican from Forsyth County, detailed his latest plan for Medicaid expansion.
Don't call it Medicaid expansion.
You're stealing from my script. He might not have used the M word, but we will. Why? Because we're not afraid of Phil Berger. I'm kidding. I'm just playing. The proposal dubbed North Carolina Healthcare for Working Families Act, they are not calling it Medicaid expansion, would provide medical coverage for an estimated 500,000 people, or about 480,000. If, big if, three ifs, capital letter FFF, if it ever becomes law. What struck you about this proposal?
Well, first off, the proposal with which some of us have come to call NICWFOM.
Don't we have enough shortenings in government? Do we really need another?
Well, I mean, because it's long, right? It's the North Carolina, NICWFOM.
Oh, can we not call this Medicaid expansion proposal?
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, already,
yeah.
Already on our site, we got a comment from one of Greg Murphy's primary opponents, who claimed on the Tom and Sadie show that North Carolina, that Carolina Cares or NICWFOM is not Medicaid expansion. And Greg Saris, I think is how you say his name, writes on our comments page, "It most certainly is. It's a backdoor way to appear to have a conservative alternative while essentially mirroring all the requirements and obligations and costs associated with Medicaid expansion." So, you know, I think that's part of the issue, is the political problem with the base in the Republican Party, that they don't want this. I think the rhetoric coming out of the Senate is that this is going to provide insurance for able-bodied adults, you know, and they don't deserve it. And the Senate proposal is instead to, I mean, it's all sort of mixed up with kind of the the differences of opinion between the House and the Senate. The Senate proposal would add a work requirement to our traditional Medicaid program and also require us to first clear a 12,000-person waiting list for the innovations waiver. I'm making little quote marks, which is a separate Medicaid program that is geared toward people with developmental and intellectual disabilities to help them function more fully in the community. And there's a very long waiting list, and that's a huge problem. I've been looking for someone to give me the quote about, actually I did get someone to give me the quote about, like, walking and chewing gum at the same time. Advocates say that we can do both. Shortening this waiting list, you know, these are patients on the waiting list for innovations waivers.
Right.
It costs about $30,000 a year for each person. So the Senate's proposing $41 million to clear the first 1,000 and then, you know, a second 1,000 in the second year of the biennium. You know, and that's a lot of money. Can I swear on the podcast?
Please, go ahead.
I think the term of art is it's a shit ton of money.
Okay.
To get to clearing this waiting list before we go to Medicaid expansion, right? And whereas the House members are saying, we can do this. We can do Medicaid expansion and not cost the state anything because we'll do an assessment on hospitals. will do a tax on the managed care companies' premiums, which the managed care companies in other states have welcomed in order to have that expansion population. It gives them more customers. They get more revenue. And then, you know, what it does is it kind of suppresses price growth, because then hospitals in the system don't have as much uncompensated care that they're having to, it's all this cost shifting that takes place in healthcare, right? So, you know, you have someone who walks in, they're uncompensated, they have an expensive problem at the hospital kind of eats the cost, they pass the cost along to everybody, including Medicaid people. So, but, you know, I think the politics of this also, our dear departed colleague, Mark Binker, when I first came here one time in like 2012, and I said to him, well, hey, they're all Republicans. Like, what's the deal? Why is the Senate and the House fighting? And he said to me, when I first came here, some old wag said to me, son, the other party is the opposition. The other chamber is the enemy. And that plays out a lot
in
this building.
That persists for sure. There's a lot to unpack.
Oh, so much to unpack.
With Medicaid. I should just preface, unfortunately, we're not going to get to all of it today. I want to stick with the work requirement for a moment. We'll note, or just as a reminder, some of the numbers here. I believe, stop me at any point, it's 37 states that have expanded Medicaid at this point. The cost for North Carolina, were this bill to ever be enacted, would be about $4.7 billion. The federal government puts up 90% of Medicaid costs.
Correct.
As it currently stands. Work requirements.
On that population, yes.
Work requirements. There are 15 states that have passed some sort of work requirement tethered to Medicaid.
Oh, you've done your research.
But one of those, I can't come in totally useless across from you. There is only one state that is not pending or had that work requirement halted by a federal lawsuit, I believe, and I believe that's Indiana. I'm not trying to quiz you right now.
Yes.
But as we talk about work requirements,
and actually, and there was a lawsuit just filed on New Hampshire.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there's litigation pretty much everywhere. There are at least two states, North Carolina and Idaho, that right now are talking about work requirements. They have
Correct.
Proposed mm-hmm. work requirements. Just remind us why this, from a political and or policy standpoint, why work requirements are such a central issue of Medicaid.
It comes back to that whole, let's talk about like the deserving poor, right? This is a really, really old idea that some folks who are poor because they deserve it. Right. Like that they've you know, they're too lazy to work, or they're, you know, or doing whatever, or they don't want to work or whatever. You know, frankly, I come from an Irish family. During the Irish famine, that was part of the rhetoric amongst the English, was that the Irish were too lazy to work. They didn't deserve food, even though they were producing food and shipping it to England. Right. So the deserving poor, this is something we see repeated. But we see this repeated in particular through American history. It kind of reverbs. And so I think that's part of the, if that's your philosophical framework, that's part of the objection mm-hmm. to just giving people health care. Now, I guess part of the reason why I'm here is because I did a long flesh mm-hmm. out. You know, I got mm-hmm. tired of hearing the he said, she said in mm-hmm. North Carolina. I've written the same damn story for 6 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, Binker and I, back in 2015, when they were fighting about whether to do Medicaid managed care, Binker and I would sit, you know, down from one another and say, can I just, like, republish the story I wrote last week? Like, we've done this so many times, right? So I just got tired of it. And so I said to myself, self, you know, how are you going to tell this story differently this year? And I decided I was going to look around the country, because I've heard all the rhetoric here, and I've done the stories about, well, this side says this, and advocates say that, and this politician says this. And I said, I'm going to just, like, talk to people around the country in primarily red states that have expanded Medicaid. So I started making phone calls. I actually went to Ohio first. I ended up on the phone with the guy from their Medicaid office. And then talked to National Governors Association, health economists, people in Colorado, all kinds of people. They pointed me toward Montana. And the reason I bring this up is that in Montana, they did an incredible presentation showing what happened and who ended up getting expanded Medicaid. They had about 96,000 people, and I'm going to get them wrong, so I'm scrolling quickly to find their actually, I've got a picture of it in my thing. So working family members of the people who got...
I'm holding up my finger because I just wanted to add a little bit of context here. Montana is a state of just more than a million people.
Correct.
So we're talking about 10% of the population.
Correct.
Roughly.
Yeah, about 96,000 people.
And Montana is a state where Republicans lead the legislature.
Correct.
And there is a Democrat, something Bullock, Steve Bullock maybe, Sean Bullock, it's an S name, but a Democrat who is the executive. So
I didn't even ask that. I just wanted to know what happened. And I knew that the legislature was primarily Republican. And a bunch of folks said, hey, they got some national consultants to do a review, and they did a terrific presentation. So it's a great slide deck, and I, looked through it. It was eye-popping. So I used one of the slides in my story. So for those folks who got, expanded Medicaid coverage in Montana, more than 8 in 10 live in a family where someone works. 7 in 10 are themselves working. It was actually 67%. Of the 33% who were left over, 12% was disabled or ill, 11% caregiving, 6% in school, and 4% were other. So that's about 3,600 people who weren't really
out of 100,000.
Out of 96,000.
Okay, almost.
Making, not like who don't fall under any of the, who are actually working and like, right? So these are the folks. And then what Montana did, which I found to be super interesting, was they created a work program or a training program that was geared specifically toward that 3,600 people who were getting care through or getting insurance through the expanded Medicaid to help them get work skills, soft skills, training, and eventually into jobs. So, and I think that's what allowed it to be palatable to the legislature. So I think that's part of what's out there is that people really feel like, well, these folks should be working. But I think we've seen it in North Carolina that, it's sort of like 6 in 10 people, the estimate, are already working. I mean, so it's a philosophical thing, but I think when it all comes down to it, I think part of it is that this was a Democratic initiative, and right now the governor wants it, and continuing to oppose it
looks good.
Is politically expedient for folks who have a conservative primary base.
You are data driven. You're not going to like this next question, but you kind of led me into it there, and perhaps you already answered it. And I'll just rip this. But how much of the opposition, if you care to, offer a fraction, a percentage of it, has to deal with the concern of, from the Republican standpoint, if Medicaid were to be expanded, that is a big, huge ceremonial victory lap that Roy Cooper gets to take in 2020, and that's a concern.
I'm sure that's a big part of it.
A majority of it?
Oh, gee, I don't know. I couldn't.
Okay.
I couldn't handicap it that way. Well, I mean, think about it. The first thing Cooper did when he came in was he said, I want to expand Medicaid. And the legislature was like, talk to the hand, Roy.
Well, the first thing he did was he said to lawmakers, I'll see you in court if I believe these laws are unconstitutional. I guess he hadn't been sworn in at that point. You're right. Once he was sworn in, that's the first thing he did.
Because there was this, they wanted to get it rolling before Obama left office, right? So
precisely, yes.
They moved fast on that, and the legislature was like, no.
Not so fast.
Right, yeah, no.
Mr. Asbury, Asbury. Rose Hoban, founder of North Carolina Health News here on the podcast, NorthCarolinaHealthNews.org. Thank you. Hello. You can follow Rose on Twitter at Rose Hoban, also at NC Health News on Twitter as well.
And NC Health News is if you really want to know the policy.
It's the best healthcare source of reporting in the state.
Well, I mean,
can
but
I
also.
Say that? Or, well,
yeah,
is that okay?
I'll take it.
I think
I'll
you'd take
it.
That. Okay. What were you gonna say?
But, the Twitter account to follow is NC Health News.
Right.
I mean, me, it's like I do, I do NC Health News. But we have basically there's four or five people who are tweeting under NC Health News. And so you're getting stuff somebody was like, wait a minute. I saw you, you're here, but I saw you tweeting from Charlotte. And I was like, we're everywhere.
She's everywhere. She's lurking. You wrote this big Medicaid piece a week ago Monday, 3,600 words or so. I'm sure there were a lot of moments within that story that were aha moments for you, whether you're on the phone with Ohio or whether you're sitting down with a public health person. But there was an interview in particular that stood out for you in the course of this reporting.
Well, you know, you write a – so this – it took about – well, there's a couple things. One is it took about 6 weeks to do the reporting. So people may have thought that, like – because John Kasich led the story, right? And
Former governor of Ohio, very famously expanded Medicaid, right?
And so the rural center that was bringing him to the state, and they called me and they said, do you want to talk to John Kasich? I was like, and it was like, that's what I need for my lead, right? I need a governor who's done this, who's a Republican. And so that was like, that was one sort of thing. And, you know, I get him and I do the interview. Actually, they said as I was walking in, their the rural center's flack, and he says to me, oh, he's kind of hard, he's irascible. And I was like, dude, I work at the legislature. Like, I can, like, and he can actually, and one of the rural center people came up to me the other day and said to me, you know what my favorite moment from your interview with Kasich, because they all stood around and, like, watched me interview him, right? Was at one point in time, Kasich was irascible. He was really hard to get a quote out of. I had all my questions, and I'd say to him, well, this is what somebody in Ohio said about, you know, someone from the right said about Euro, and he'd be like, I'm not even going to listen to that. You know, I don't respond to bloggers, blah, 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 right? And he kept cutting me short. And finally, like, he kept cutting me short, and finally I was like, let me finish. I put on my best schoolmarm voice, and I was like, and I'm like, damn, I'm saying that to, like, John Kasich. Oops.
It's the freedom of not being in office anymore or running for office. The
correct,
ability to speak candidly.
Yeah.
I think that's a large part of it.
Yeah. So, but there was another one. So I'm writing the story and I'm getting near the end, and I knew that they were going to, well, they had initially announced they were going to roll out this Medicaid expansion story or this Medicaid expansion bill last Tuesday. So I was like, oh, got to run this story ahead of that. Right. Kind of set the stage. So I wanted to run it on Monday morning. So it's like Friday. And there's a Louisiana. Now, what you pod listeners don't know.
Oh, you're about to.
Is that Jeff and I have partied together in.
Partied?
We partied hardy in New Orleans at New Orleans Jazz Fest. Because my old housemate from 30 years ago is a native New Orleanian. And so I heard that Jeff, you know, so she had a party and a bunch of us showed up. And it was all these journalists, right? So so I call Martha, right? And first off, I had already spoken to the Louisiana Medicaid people, like, on, like, Wednesday. And I call Martha, and I realized I needed more color in the bottom half of the story. And I call Martha. I'm like, Martha, because she works in public health. Martha, you got to know somebody who works in a clinic. She's like, sure, I do. I'll give you my friend Tanya. So, and I said, yeah, because I've already spoken to someone at the governor's office. And she said, oh, who'd you speak to? Was it Nick? Because she knows everybody.
She knows everybody. She's
knows
connected.
Everybody.
Yes.
It's hilarious. Right? This is what happens when you have, like, tendrils all over the country. So Martha's friend Tanya, who is a nurse practitioner in a clinic in Metairie, calls me back. I'm covered head to toe in dust and mud because it was Saturday afternoon. I'm driving my friend's truck back from the nursery, and I've got trees and bushes in the back. Right? And I'm in, like, you know, rural Orange County, and a dog in the truck with me, like, the whole thing. And Tanya calls me, and I'm like, wait, Tanya, I gotta pull over somewhere. Wait, hold on. And I'm like, you know, spraying gravel. And I interviewed her, you know, taping on the phone in the parking lot of a Baptist church in rural Orange County.
It's a fitting setting for the conclusion of a Medicaid story.
Exactly. It was a great interview, too.
Louisiana is one of two states in the Southeast where Medicaid has been expanded.
Correct.
Arkansas is the other.
Mm-hmm.
This is the generic question that you've heard a bunch of times and you don't necessarily love, but handicap for us the likelihood of some sort of expansion this year and what...
You throw your hands up.
And that's fine. We can leave it there.
I long ago stopped making predictions about this body.
I don't need to make a prediction. Do you have a hunch? Do you think, I mean, reading the political tea leaves with where we are, both in this state with hyper-bipartisanship and ramped up rhetoric on the national scene? I mean, I want you to sit on that question for a minute. If you want to answer it please do. But I'm also, I'm gonna stack another question in here, and you can touch on this one as well if you want. You and I have had the discussion about just how the rhetoric really is ramped up. I will use the word disingenuous. Some of it is disingenuous. Is there rhetoric frequently used in the Medicaid conversation in the state that is most frustrating or most disingenuous to you as somebody who follows this very closely, that's just truly not helpful to perhaps the, I mean, I guess everything could be helpful from the political side, depending on your perspective, but from that policy perspective?
Geez, I don't know. I mean,
I'm trying to get you in trouble with that question.
Of course you're trying to get me in trouble with the question. I guess the thing that's sort of not disingenuous, but like, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, there's a line that this doesn't matter for rural hospitals. Mm-hmm. This matters for rural hospitals.
Tremendously. Matters for the bottom line. Matters
huge for, yeah. for rural hospitals. And if you're going to say that, you know, expanding or not doesn't matter for rural hospitals, you really, that's no.
It's not accurate. It's not helpful.
No, I mean, in everyone I spoke to, the data are clear that of the rural hospitals that have closed, and rural hospitals have struggled across the country, more hospitals have closed in states that have not expanded. They're more likely. Greg Tung, who is a health economist at the University of Colorado, he was very clear on that. He said the numbers are very clear on that. The policy person from the National Rural Health Association. And, you know, like, and part of it, like, people say, well, part of the problem is Obama. Well, yeah, of course, right? Part of the problem was the Obama administration, because one of the things they did was there was this tax bill that was pushed through before the Affordable Care Act. And part of the understanding was, well, hey, guys, you're going to all have insured patients rather than these uncompensated patients. And and so you don't get these disproportionate share payments anymore. And so the hospitals went along because they were going to get more insured patients. And then when the Supreme Court made Medicaid expansion optional, and mind you, rural counties are poorer, they have more people on government programs like Medicaid and Medicare. So...
But they can be both very white and very black. They can be both very Republican and very Democrat.
Correct. Yeah. Right. But and I mean, I think, you know, and it's interesting because I remember in 2012 when I was, you know, before the Supreme Court ruling and they were going to roll out the Affordable Care Act. And then like the Supreme Court ruling came. And I remember talking to people from the Hospital Association, now the Healthcare Association. They were like, well, we're talking to, you know, working behind the scenes and stuff like that. And then, boom, you know, like here comes the right. Senate, like Senate Bill 4. And they were like, hell no, right? But, and there were, and I had someone tell me this off the record, so I'm not going to mention the hospital, but there was a semi-rural hospital in this state whose board told the CEO, you are not to say anything about Medicaid expansion. And that hospital was later gobbled up by one of the big boys in the state, right? So I think people saw this through a political lens and neglected to look at the finances, particularly in rural healthcare, and the way that this has, the way that not having more paying patients in rural hospitals has really hamstrung them.
Rose Hoban. Formerly of WUNC, by the way. Haven't mentioned that. We're 20-plus minutes here into the program.
That's okay.
Writes for North Carolina Health News. That's a loaded response. I'm just kidding. One more topic I want to get to, and then we're going to fire off some quick hitters before.
Oh, it's a really easy topic, too.
Real easy topic we're moving to. Companion bills running in each chamber. This is an abortion issue. Legislation related to specifically late-term procedures and babies who are born alive. Despite those late-term procedures, the issue was nudged on, we believe, from what we gather this week, a little bit by late-term restrictions being rolled back in the state of New York. Also, some comments made by Virginia Governor Ralph Northam
and
recently.
And also that a federal judge threw out North
yes.
Carolina's long-standing...
Well, not long-standing. It's only 2 weeks old.
No. 2 years no, old. But that ban on
ban
procedures
on, yes.
post 20 weeks, that ban... was enacted in 1973. And if you read the court case, what Judge Osteen says is that ban has been in place for a very long time, but it was not enforced.
Right. All right. So
essentially, it wasn't enforced. So then the actions taken by the General Assembly in 2015 provided enough of a chilling effect mm-hmm. for physicians that essentially it gave teeth. Because Osteen discusses this at great length in his decision, because a big part of the question was, did the plaintiffs have standing to sue? It's a group of providers. So it was a handful of independent OBGYNs and Planned Parenthood and ACLU.
So, right. So just to roll this context in, there's an abortion bill moving at the North Carolina legislature here. It is partially because of a ban on abortions later than 20 weeks in North Carolina. That was recently struck down. That's one.
Correct. They have 60 days to come up with a legislative solution.
There are these other out-of-state issues that have happened as well.
Correct.
Some of what we heard this week was this claim that babies who are born following late-term abortions, born alive, die because doctors let them die or are assisted
in dying
into death.
There's also one of the other out-of-state things that was mentioned was Dr. Kermit Gosnell, who was an abortion provider in Pennsylvania, who I think anyone would agree, like, went way off the farm.
Oh, I mean, this stuff, that's unconscionable, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that yes, people like that, yeah. I mean, that's the worst of the worst. Is there any data? What kind of numbers do we have to support that this stuff, these terrible instances happen?
So this is bubbled up, right? This is bubbled up out there in the universe. And so Congress made a request of the CDC back in 2016, and they did a chart review, and they looked at, and the way they're able to do it is looking at ICD-9 codes, which are the medical codes, right?
Layperson's terms.
Okay, the medical codes, like when you go to the hospital that, you know.
How you code things for billing.
For billing, right? So they were able to look at this. So they looked at a 12-year period. So I think it was Representative McElrath misspoke today, because mm-hmm. she said that the CDC found that there were more than 500 a year. It was actually 500 deaths over the course of a 12-year period. It was 588 deaths.
But just to be clear, when we're talking about these deaths, these are deaths by natural causes? These are.
So what it was is they were classified and coded mm-hmm. With a mention of induced termination. Let me see. Termination of pregnancy, pardon me. And then of those, a quarter of them could, quote, definitively, this is from the CDC, definitively classified as involving an induced termination. So it's so what we're looking at in a period of time where there were 49 million births, that there were 143 of these induced terminations that resulted in death, where the baby was born alive. And they talk about sort of like vagueness of terms. And so of that 143 deaths, 97 involved a maternal complication, I'm reading from the CDC's report, or one or more congenital anomalies. 25 of those children died within 10 minutes, 35 died within an hour, 68 died within 4 hours, and 6 lived for a day or more.
There's no evidence to support that doctors have killed babies or are killing babies. Have you ever heard that in your reporting? You're a nurse. Have you ever seen that in the delivery room?
No. I mean, like, I didn't work in L&D, but a labor and delivery. But, I mean, the folks I spoke to, and of course, you know, like, it's the he said, she said. You know, I spoke to a couple of OBGYNs in the past day, and they were like, no, right? Whereas you have folks who support this bill saying, of course, and Representative McElrath, who I think made her living as a phlebotomist, talked about, you know, when she was starting work in the 70s that she would see this. Now, I have no way of knowing. I have no way of knowing. It is not anything that has ever entered into my ken. Now, that being said, mm-hmm. and I have had several friends who have chosen to terminate pregnancies late. I have one friend who was like 18 weeks mm-hmm. and one who was probably right around 20 weeks. And they talked about like how wrenching it was. These were pregnancies that people wanted. Mm-hmm. But you do the genetic testing and the ultrasound and all this stuff, and they find out that there are these anomalies, fetal anomalies, that are incompatible with life, is the term of art, you know, the people are talking about. And so they go in for a termination. Very, and late term is, you know, late term I think is a loaded term, because late term really means that you've gone beyond 40 weeks and you're waiting, right? So it's sort of like post 20 week. I think it's sort of a more accurate way to put it is post 20 week abortion.
Right, I'm not flipping, but it's almost second half, or it's second.
Second trimester.
Well,
second trimester ends 26 weeks.
Right, but second trimester begins at 13 weeks, right?
Right. So it's late second trimester.
Right.
You could say
halfway
late second.
But sometimes,
so
that,
so Northam, I went back and actually listened to the quote that Northam came up with, you know, like that, because it was Governor Ralph Northam, who is a pediatric neurologist.
I believe so, yeah.
Right? So he, so I listened. It was about a minute out of like a 43-minute conversation that he had with a local radio station, and most of the conversation was about traffic and roadways. And then, mm-hmm. you know, they posed this question, and he said, and I quoted him in my story at a little more length, and he basically said, you know, that these procedures were done in cases where, quote, there might be severe deformities, there may be a fetus that's non-viable. He went on to explain that the fetus would be delivered, the infant would be kept comfortable, the infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired, and then a discussion would ensue between the physicians and the mother. So, you know, I think, and I can picture that happening, right? I think the picture in my head, having spent a lot of time with healthcare providers, is, oh my God, this is awful, right? You've got this baby that's being born. It's got, you know, it has no brain, or it has no kidneys. And we're really sorry. What do you want us to do, right? And do you want us to resuscitate this child? Do you want us to make the child comfortable? Which is part of what was at, I mean, that was part of what was being talked about today in committee, was palliative care, mm-hmm. right? Because I did work as a hospice nurse.
Which is terminal care,
yeah. Which is you make the patient comfortable, but you don't do anything heroic.
Right.
And I mean, I'm truly curious, like, if this has occurred and this infant is now born but is not yet expired, and so the bill is saying that, and I'm not clear on it, is the bill like compelling the healthcare team to resuscitate, or does palliative care count? I mean, that's what I'm trying to get, like, I'm wondering.
And just, I mean, maybe to stick with one something you just said a moment ago, which is, what if a child is born without a necessary organ, like a
right.
kidney or liver? And
right.
I mean, I don't. You're a medical professional. I'm never ever going to pretend to be one. But I'm thinking that a baby might be able to survive for a few minutes or a little while without
right.
one of those organs. But that's
right.
out.
And then, so what's
you
the care?
You can't do a kidney transplant.
So what kind of care do you deliver? Right? What is and I guess what I'm hearing the proponents of this bill is saying that, well, you know, these children are not being comforted, these children are not being held, these children are not being, or do they need to be resuscitated? I mean, I'm truly unclear.
Right, which is, I'm not trying to question anybody's sincerely held beliefs, but this, I think, is the point of the conversation where it is important for me to note that abortion is there.
It's the most divisive issue in American politics
but
today.
There's also a
none.
Political component here. And as sincerely held, as all the sincerely held beliefs, all of the beliefs, we're just going to put them in a little box and put them over here for a second. And we're also going to note that I think there is clearly a desire here to put a bill like this on the governor's desk and dare him to veto this.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't be surprised that that's part
of the
calculus.
That's the political component. Yes, that's the part of the calculation of this.
So something I do want to point out something. In the research I did for the story that we ran this morning mm-hmm. on this bill, So I go and look at the North Carolina's abortion stats. And
made available by the state.
Made available by the State Center for Health Statistics.
Okay.
Right? Online, easily accessible. And I do this about around like March, April of every year. You get like, it's like a year long lag. So I'm looking at the 2017 stats. And what I found really interesting is that, and this sort of speaks to the folks who were the plaintiffs in that 20-week ban case.
That challenged North Carolina's 20-week ban.
That challenged North Carolina's 20-week ban that had been there for, you know, decades, but like no one really bothered with it, right? They were saying that there had been a chilling effect. And what you can see in the stats is that there were 37 of these post 20, you know, 21 weeks and beyond abortions that North Carolina women had in 2017. All but one took place out of state. So what that tells me is that physicians already in this state don't want to do this. So this bill would push that last person out of state? I mean, like...
Just to reiterate that stat, because I'm my mind was wandering, candidly. There's one abortion that took place in North Carolina after 20 weeks for all of 2017, for all of North Carolina? Is that, did I hear
correct,
it?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I'm not trolling
that's,
you.
That's according to the state stats. Okay. And there are some people who say there's unknown, about 700. There's been part of the 2015 law tightened up all of those unknowns. So, you know, you used to have like 1,200 that you didn't have the stats on. Now there's like 700 that you don't have the stats on. So you could say, oh, that entire 700, right? You know, I don't know where they are. But like, if you look at that, it was something like, oh, and I forget, I could find the number here. But, you know, it was something like 18,000 abortions that took place in 2017. And of them, 22,846 abortion, and out of them, one was later than 21 weeks and took place in state. So I think the words that I used in my story is vanishingly small. Now, you can say that one is too many.
Right? But that was just one late-term abortion. You don't even know if that baby survived.
Right, yeah, that's a good point.
We don't know that. We're going to drop a pin in this here. We're going to move on to the various...
The lightning round?
Yeah.
We're
going to move on to the various and sundry portion of the afternoon. 1 year sabbatical. You can go anywhere in the world, but you have to stay in a 100-mile radius. Where are you going and how are you getting there?
Of here?
No, of wherever you go. You can go anywhere in the world, but you have to stay within a 100-mile radius of wherever you go.
Oh, wow. That's really tough.
Where are you going and how are you getting there?
Oh, golly. Well, my husband and I went to Portugal over the holidays and loved it. I could spend a year in Portugal and I would take a ship.
Yeah. Cruise ship or freight ship? A freighter.
Do the freighter thing. That'd be kind of fun. I could spend a year in Lisbon. Easy.
You could work on the deck going across the Atlantic.
I'd be the nurse for where, right? Okay. I'd, you know, cut up, you know, do people's bruises. I like that idea.
2 years. It's been almost 2 years since our colleague and friend Mark Binker passed away.
God.
What do you miss most about Binker?
Have you noticed what I've got over on my desk? I have a little green post-it note.
Uh-huh.
And it's taped to my desk, and it says WWBW.
What would Binker do?
What would Binker write?
Oh, sorry.
And that was what inspired my Medicaid deep dive. What would Binker have written about this? He would have gone, he would have looked beyond the rhetoric. And that's what I miss about Mark. He was so good at looking beyond the rhetoric.
Having second and third and 10th day stories, sometimes within that first day story.
Oh, God,
was,
yeah.
Yeah, he was great.
He was great. And he was a really nice guy.
He was a good man.
We miss him.
Three easy best practices for improved general health.
Poof. Drink more water.
One.
Move more.
Okay.
Does bourbon count?
If you honestly are saying that as a nurse, that's an easy best practice for improved general health.
Fine. I need fruits and vegetables. Bourbon.
Rose Hopeman is, I guess, apparently still a nurse. She also leads North Carolina Health News. You can read her reporting and the reporting of some of her talented staff at NorthCarolinaHealthNews.org. Follow them on Twitter, NC Health News. Rose, appreciate you coming back on the podcast.
And yeah, like, and just, you know, you had me talking about some real like slam dunky easy stuff. Thanks, dude.
You signed up for it. This time I'm walking to New Orleans. Glad to have you along on this latest edition of the podcast. You can subscribe to it on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Leave a review wherever it is that you get that on-demand listening. Then throughout the week, stay up to date with what is happening at your state legislature at our website, wunc.org. For Rose, I'm Jeff. Enjoy your weekend. We'll talk to you again soon. I've got my suitcase in my hand. I'm leaving here today. Yes, I'm going back home to stay. Yes, I'm walking to